Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau steps down.
Justin Trudeau will go down in history as a very, very bad Prime Minister.
We go inside the ruins of a Palestinian refugee camp in Syria.
Few places in this country so clearly show the brutality of the 13-year civil war. Like so many other places in Syria, Assad's forces pummeled this area.
And we'll look at how the war against Hamas has impacted immigration in Israel.
The war deepened my connection to the Israeli people, to the Jewish homeland, and made me want to be with more people like myself.
Today is Tuesday, January 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We begin today's show in Ottawa, Canada. That's where Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced he will step down as leader of the ruling Liberal Party. And once a replacement prime minister can be found, he'll step down as leader of the country after 9 years in office. For a look at what this means for Canada, I'm joined by Andrew Latham, Senior Washington Fellow at the Institute for Peace and Diplomacy and a professor of international relations at McAllister College.
Well, he sort of resigned, although not entirely, because we're not sure exactly how this is going to unfold, but he's done.
So he's resigning as the party leader. Effective yes. Today, basically. And now it's up to the party to choose a new prime minister, not the voters.
That's right. And you know, he's going to prorogue the parliament. And so that's going to be March 24th. And we don't know how that's going to unfold. And we don't know quite whether he's going to be the interim leader or, I mean, there's a lot of unknowns here, right?
So still a lot to figure out, but what we do know is that if he's no longer the leader of the party and eventually he's going to resign as prime minister, at some point soon, the Canadian public will get to choose between the Liberal Party's candidate, someone to come after Trudeau, and a Conservative Party's candidate, I would imagine, correct? When might that happen?
Well, after March 24th, there'll be at some point there'll be an election, not too distant future, and Pierre Poilievre is obviously going to win that election. But what I'm predicting is that the Conservatives will be in the majority; they will win the election. And Justin Trudeau will go down in history as a very, very bad prime minister.
I want to get back to what you said in just a moment about him being a bad prime minister, but tell us how we got here. Even if you say he was bad, he was popular enough to be prime minister for 9 years.
Well, he was, but the Liberal government that he headed failed in all sorts of ways. Canada has really declined over the last 9+ years in all sorts of ways. When I look at the per capita GDP compared to the United States, it's gone from about 83% to about 73%. I mean, Canada's really failing in all kinds of ways, especially with respect to affordable housing. And I mean, we could go on and on and on. He and his government have been a total failure for the last, well, I wouldn't say 10 years, 9 years since he was elected, but for the last 4 or 5 years, totally in the tank.
And what are the Conservatives offering in terms of policy changes that would be any different?
Well, Pierre Poilievre is talking very much about growth, economic growth, really weird little things like exporting liquid natural gas and really doubling down on the on those sorts of things. He's also speaking a lot about the affordability of housing. I think he's making a lot of the right noises. I don't know that he can deliver, but he's making a lot of the right noises.
Is there a sense in Canada that Trudeau just doesn't have what it takes to go toe-to-toe with Donald Trump?
Yeah, that's exactly what I think. I don't think he has what it takes. I think the Premier of Alberta has what it takes. I think maybe even Doug Ford has what it takes in Ontario. I'm pretty convinced that Pierre Poilievre has what it takes, but Justin Trudeau does not have what it takes. So it's good that he's gone. And I'm not sure who's going to be his successor as the head of the Liberal Party. And that's a complicated situation, as you know. But anything is better than Justin.
And I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there for today. Andrew Latham is a professor of international relations and political theory at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota. He's also a senior Washington fellow for the Institute for Peace and Diplomacy. Professor, thanks so much for being with us. Thanks for your analysis.
Right. Cheers. Thank you.
Now to Syria. The Palestinian refugee camp of Yarmouk in the outskirts of Damascus offers a glimpse of the brutality of Syria's civil war. Home to more than 150,000 people, Yarmouk was destroyed during the early years of the war. Now, many are trying to return to rebuild their devastated homes and their lives. Jan Boyshat reports.
The streets are empty. The buildings are abandoned ruins. Life seems to have gone away, with very few traces left behind. This is Yarmouk, a former Palestinian refugee camp less than 10 kilometers from the center of Damascus, the otherwise charming and vibrant capital of Syria. Few places in this country so clearly show the brutality of the 13-year civil war. Like so many other places in Syria, Assad's forces pummeled this area in their hunt for jihadists. Yarmouk's destruction is like a sword that doesn't heal, an open wound that illustrates a violent past at a time when peace is too new to trust and the future too unpredictable.
Walking through these streets, you can have an idea how brutal the regime of Bashar al-Assad was against the civilian population during the civil war. Here, everything is destroyed. This neighborhood used to have more than 150,000 people living here. Now, it's a ghost town.
Hossein Joma is a mechanic who says he remained in Yarmouk during the civil war and has vivid memories of what happened here.
They used everything they had here, missiles, bombs, airstrikes. The regime used every weapon at its disposal and many people died, entire families, children, civilians.
His family and a few others live here on the southern edge of Yarmouk. He believes old neighbors will be returning soon. Since the dramatic fall of Bashar al-Assad's regime last month, many who fled the civil war are coming back to see what is left of their homes. Some are determined to clear the debris and restart their lives despite all the challenges.
As soon as we were allowed to come back, we came and found our house like this. Everything was looted. Everything was burned.
Hussein left with his family when the battles began in 2011.
They were shootings and airstrikes all the time. It was so difficult that you expected to be killed at any moment.
Now he's trying to rebuild the house where he spent most of his life. With the help of family, he hopes to return to Yarmouk by the summer, if the war is truly over, he says. Nobody knows exactly how many people are living in Yarmouk now. By 2018, the number had dropped to as low as 800 residents, according to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. People here believe that tens of thousands will return soon. They say life outside this camp is even more difficult, and often a choice between paying expensive rent or staying in a makeshift shelter in the desert. Ian Buesha, VOA News, Damascus, Syria.
In recent months, right-wing parties have gained popularity and power in Europe. That trend continues in Austria after centrists were unable to form a governing coalition. So now, the far-right Freedom Party, or FPO, has a chance. Diane Toe of Reuters has that story.
Austria's leadership swung towards the far right on Monday as its president tasked the leader of the Eurosceptic Russia-friendly Freedom Party with forming a coalition government. It comes after a centrist attempt to assemble one without the party, known as FPO, unexpectedly collapsed over the weekend. President Alexander van der Bellen announced the news after the meeting with FPO leader Herbert Kickl.
Herr Kickl.
Mr. Kickl has the confidence to find viable solutions within the framework of government negotiations, and he wants this responsibility. I asked him that explicitly. I have therefore instructed him to enter into talks with the OVP to form a federal government. Herbert Kickl will report to me on the progress of these talks on an ongoing basis.
The announcement marks a dramatic reversal for the president, who used to lead the left-wing Greens and has long been critical of the FPO. Protesters gathered outside the presidential palace, holding up signs saying they did not want a right-wing extremist Austria. The FPO was founded in the 1950s by a former senior officer in Hitler's elite paramilitary SS. It came first in September's parliamentary election for the first time, with more than 29% of the vote. It has been in power before as a junior coalition partner, but has never led a government. Chancellor Karl Nehammer resigned on Saturday after his conservative OVP party failed to forge a centrist coalition. He had insisted his party would not govern with Kickl, calling him a conspiracy theorist and security threat. The OVP's interim leader, Christian Stocker, said on Sunday he was open to talks with Kickl. The two parties overlap on various issues, both taking a tough line on immigration. Thorny topics include how to shrink a budget deficit and the FPO's opposition to aid for Ukraine in its war against Russia. If the new round of coalition talks fail, a snap election is likely, and opinion polls show support for the FPO has only grown since September.
It's Diane Toe of Reuters reporting for us. And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Federal offices and public schools in Washington, D.C. were closed on Monday as the first major winter storm of the new year swept across the U.S. mid-Atlantic. The National Weather Service said more than 12.5 centimeters of snow had fallen in the nation's capital by midday on Monday, with up to 30 centimeters in the surrounding areas. Governors in several states, including Kansas, Kentucky, Arkansas, West Virginia, Virginia, and Maryland, had already declared states of emergency. A human rights organization has released a list of 54 security and political prisoners sentenced to death in Iran. According to a new report published Monday by the human rights activists in Iran non-governmental organization, the death sentences for these security and political prisoners have been upheld by Iran's Supreme Court, and their cases have been referred to the execution branch for implementation. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer on Monday condemned what he's calling lies and misinformation that he said are undermining UK democracy in response to a barrage of attacks on his government from the American businessman Elon Musk. The billionaire Tesla CEO has taken an intense and erratic interest in British politics since the centre-left Labour Party was elected in July. Musk has used his social network X to call for new elections and demand Starmer be imprisoned. On Monday, Musk posted an online poll for his 210 million followers on the proposition that America should liberate the people of Britain from their tyrannical government. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. And now, in American domestic politics, January 6th is the day mandated by the U.S. Constitution that Congress must certify the presidential election so the new president can be inaugurated on January 20th. An interesting twist this time around is that Vice President Kamala Harris must certify the election she lost. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has our story.
4 years after the most tumultuous certification of election results in U.S. history, a quiet and orderly process Monday, as the U.S. Congress certifies that Donald Trump won the 2024 election. The new Senate Majority Leader John Thune hailed the victory.
Republicans improved our margins in nearly 90%.
of counties in the United States and grew support with nearly every demographic group. The Republican coalition is broad and strong and growing. Now the work begins of delivering on our agenda. And Mr. President, Republicans are ready to go.
Despite her loss to Trump, Vice President Kamala Harris fulfilled her constitutional duty of presiding over the certification of the election. Only two other sitting U.S. vice presidents have presided over electoral counts after their losses for the presidency. Richard Nixon in 1961 and Al Gore in 2001.
For president and vice president.
In a taped statement earlier Monday, Harris emphasized the importance of a peaceful transfer of power.
This duty is a sacred obligation, one I will uphold, guided by love of country, loyalty to our Constitution, and my unwavering faith in the American people.
One analyst told VOA that duty is part of a long tradition of American leaders respecting the democratic process. Casey Burgett is the director of the Legislative Affairs Program at the George Washington University.
This is her role to play, that she's going to carry it out purposefully and as intended. And that just shows the commitment to a peaceful transfer of power, even and especially if you are the one on the losing end of the election. It shows a strength and a commitment to these ideals, something that we've taken for granted for too long and now need to return to.
But congressional Democrats say January 6, 2021 should not be forgotten. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Far too many individuals have tried to rewrite the history of January 6th, have tried to sweep the truth under the rug and pretend like the day was perfectly fine or even a moment of great patriotism. That is a lie, plain and simple.
In 2022, a congressional committee composed of seven Democrats and two Republicans placed the blame for January 6 on Trump for repeating lies about election fraud and allegedly inciting supporters to attack the U.S. Capitol.
Because we are not fair-weather patriots.
But Trump and many of his supporters have criticized the work of the committee as biased and suggested criminal defendants in January 6 cases should be pardoned. Trump will be sworn in for his second term as president on January 20th. Katherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
The war in Gaza has intensified the connection that many Jews around the world feel to Israel and has sparked a wave of immigration into the Jewish state. At the same time, a growing number of Israelis are leaving the country, at least temporarily. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Rachel Dalit moved from the U.S. to Israel to play professional women's soccer. A recent graduate of the University of Wisconsin, she says she felt unsafe walking through the pro-Palestinian encampments on her school's campus after the war between Israel and Hamas began in 2023. She was even attacked with a heavy object that someone threw at her when she draped an Israeli flag around her shoulders.
The war deepened my connection to the Israeli people, to the Jewish homeland, and made me want to be with more people like myself. I come from a small community of Jews in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and obviously being here, majority of people are Jewish, and just being surrounded with that on a daily is something special.
Dalit says her family is proud of her accomplishments in Israel, but worried about her safety. Israel's immigration minister, Ofir Sofer, says 33,000 immigrants have come to Israel in the past year, despite the war and rocket attacks on much of Israel. Immigrants from North America get support from Nefesh B'Nefesh, an organization that facilitates Jewish immigration. Officials with the organization say there has been a 60% increase in immigration applications in the past year, although they're not sure how many will move to the country. Mark Rosenberg is a vice president at Nefesh B'Nefesh.
When the war happened, I think there was an incredible emotional connection that people had. First was the shock and the terror of digesting what happened. But in reaction, some people really saw their connection strengthen and saw their place in Israel.
The Hamas attack of October 7th, 2023 had a personal effect on Peter Sugarman, a British private equity businessman. He and his wife were visiting Israel with their son and grandchildren on that day and had to take refuge in their hotel bomb shelter for many hours. Exactly a year later, on October 7, 2024, he and his wife became new immigrants.
My wife and I felt after that that the time had come to make a concerted effort to arrive in Israel within a year of that date. We felt that we wanted to, best way of supporting the Jewish people was to get even more involved, and that meant coming to Israel.
At the same time as immigrants are coming to Israel, many Israelis are leaving. The Central Bureau of Statistics found that more than 82,000 Israelis moved abroad in 2024, in contrast to about 35,000 in past years. Many cited the ongoing war and Israel's political unrest as reasons for leaving. Meanwhile, many of the new immigrants say they are learning to live with the frequent rocket attacks and look forward to contributing to a peaceful Israel in the future. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Turning now to Africa and the anti-government protests in Kenya this past summer, there are, it seems, several cases in which people were killed at the protests, yet the official government records reflect something different, and activists are accusing the government of covering up police brutality. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has more.
Rights groups and relatives have accused Kenyan authorities of a cover-up of dozens of alleged police killings, unexplained abductions, and illegal detentions related to these anti-government protests, known as the Gen Z protests because of the young people involved. The body of 19-year-old Charles Owino lies in the street, killed by a gunshot to the head, according to an autopsy report seen by Reuters. But police recorded his death as a road accident in the morgue logbook, his brother told Reuters. The National Police Service did not reply to questions about four such cases examined by Reuters. The battered body of another protester, Denzel Omondi, was found in a pond at an abandoned quarry on Nairobi's outskirts 9 days after he disappeared. The autopsy report seen by Reuters detailed hyperinflated lungs, as well as bruises on his head, neck, forearm, and knees. It recorded the death as drowning. But something else happened first, the family said. They said Kenya's IPOA watchdog, which probes cases of police brutality, has promised to investigate. Reuters spoke to three police officers who work in a unit deployed during protests. They described police covering their tracks by mischaracterizing deaths caused by officers as accidents, drownings, or mob justice. Thousands of young Kenyans took to the streets against tax hikes and political corruption from late June to December. Deputy President Kithure Kindiki has said 42 people were killed in a police response that rights groups say involved firing live rounds. I am on my knees. Kenya's National Commission on Human Rights, which is government-funded, also recorded 82 enforced disappearances, 29 of which remain unaccounted for. The officers who spoke to Reuters about their work requested anonymity to speak about the subject. One policeman described working undercover during the protests to organize abductions.
Me, as an officer, I'll be sent there to pretend. I'm there, but undercover. Here is the person. Take their number. I can even send him or her money and talk about going back for protests the next day. At this point, I would have got them.
The police did not respond to questions about these allegations. Otsieno Namwaya of Human Rights Watch says Kenyan police are required to take those arrested to stations, then court.
What we are seeing are people in plain clothes, hiding their faces, basically covering their faces. They abduct people in a very violent, very threatening or scary way. And then they don't even take them to police stations. So in the first place, those things should not be happening. But because it has happened, we need accountability.
The officers of Kenyan President William Ruto, his deputy president, and the Interior Ministry did not respond to requests for comment. In a late December speech, Ruto acknowledged, quote, instances of excessive and extrajudicial actions by members of the security services.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters reporting for us, and that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karasch.